Okay, so just to say a few more points about the sugya of Behemtin Shel Tzaddikim, which really is a fascinating sugya, and we could say a lot more about, but we'll just keep it to a little bit of a minimum. So just to continue a little bit from where we left off yesterday, and Maury brought to my attention that, as he was obligated to do as shir assistant, these are important things that he's got to stay on top of. Today is the yahrzeit of Rav Yosef Engel, apparently. Do you know what number? Okay, so that's very significant. Rav Yosef Engel, a tremendous gaon, who we cite often, but especially in this sugya, he is maybe the most responsible for taking this Gemara and putting it in the public sphere. You know, this Gemara has been quoted by him perhaps more than any other Achron, and he has integrated it into broad Shas sugyas in a significant way, so it's appropriate zikaron to continue this point on his yahrzeit, and especially because we were literally in between two sentences from him yesterday, so we were literally in the middle of continuing the point specifically from Rav Yosef Engel, so it's appropriate that his yahrzeit will pick up from there. So essentially what we had been discussing is that the concept of saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu protects the tzaddikim or protects others from having a takala through the tzaddikim, so that has implications in all kinds of different directions. And we saw some of them so far. And now to focus on the implication of calling this act a takala, to say that some inadvertent avera could be a takala, even though there's no actual liability, that's itself a significant statement. And we raise the question, is it true about everything? Could any inadvertent avera be termed a takala? Or might there be some actions which are less worthy of being called a takala when it's inadvertent? And by the way, we didn't even say this yet, but the idea of focusing on achila specifically, that the position of Tosfos and Rabbeinu Tam and others, that it's specifically achila where we would have this issue, calling it a gnai, and others explaining the gnai has to do with the timtum halev, or has to do with the fact that it becomes a part of you. There is, in other areas of halacha also, an extra significance to achila, not exclusively achila, but achila included. So, for example, when it comes to mezasek, right, we say that hamezasek b'chalavim v'arayos is chayev shekein nena, that since there is lemaisa a benefit that comes from the physical experience of eating, so there's an extra liability that comes with that, even when it's not fully intentional. So that presumably is relevant here also, that even if we're saying, listen, this is not an intentional aveira, this is something that was done b'shogeg or even ba'ones, so we do find that achila still has a greater impact. The fact that lemaisa, you're eating something, and lemaisa, that's real, whether or not it's something you intended to do, so that has a higher level of connection to you. So maybe that also contributes to why it would be called a takala, even when it's done without any intent. So calling it a takala, calling this action a takala, suggests that there's something inherently bad in the experience, regardless of whether you intended to do it or not. So even though you may approach it mostly innocently, or even completely innocently, honest, but apparently there's something harmful in this experience nonetheless. So that would seem to correlate to what we call in Lamdisha rescue terms, an Isser Chafza. The Chafza is, so to speak, spiritually poisonous. So it doesn't matter that you're innocent in taking it in, you have still taken in spiritual poison. So if that's what's going on here, so then the question could be, are there any things that shouldn't fall into that category? Are any averos not yisurei chafza? So Rav Yosef Engel, as we started to say yesterday, so in Klal Yud, in his Sefer Asra D'Oraisa, which I highly recommend you reading inside, especially, this is one of the most significant pieces in a very significant sefer, so it's a good way to observe his yahrzeit. You want to read this klal today, klal yod in the Asman Daraisa.
This 100th.
100th, wow, okay, that's Very significant. Okay, so you should read 100 essays from Rav Spengel today. It's not hard to find. But if you can't read all 100, so Klal Yud and the Asman Dereis is a good place to start. When I left Karen Biavna, Rebbe told me I should read Asman Dereis to cover to cover.
Okay.
So let's know, at least read Klal Yud of Asman Dereis. So here you find that he takes up the question, are some Yisurim not Yisurei Chavtza? And he discusses there that Achronim have asserted that there are certain categories that are not Yisurei Chavtza. One category is Yisurim Drabana, and the other is temporary Yisurim. What's the logic of each? So when it comes to Yisurei Drabana, here this gets into a much larger discussion of how we relate to the authority of Chazal. Do we think that Chazal really have the authority vested in them to create halachic realities and spiritual realities? Or should we say that, no, come on, God created the world, he can create spiritual realities in the world, but the rabbis don't have any power over objects, they don't have power to imbue a chicken cheeseburger with spiritual harm. They have authority over us. We are told that we are obligated to listen to them. So if we purposely violated the Rabbanan, so that's a violation of our obligation to obey the rabbis. But if we commit Nisa the Rabbanan inadvertently, with no intent to rebel, so maybe we didn't really do anything wrong. Maybe there isn't actually anything that happened. Now, there's many different degrees with which you could say that. There isn't anything that could happen, or there isn't a real aveira that happened, or there isn't any stain. So there's a lot of different degrees of formulating that statement. But that's essentially the position. And it's associated with the Nesivos HaMishpat. It's in Reish Lamed Daled. So that premise might say, might indicate that Nisra Drabanan does not take on any identity, any status in the item. And if you are inadvertent in your transgression, then essentially nothing happened. Everyone follow that? So far, so good? So if that's the case, says Rav Yosef Engel, our Gemara seems to go against that. Because our Gemara, which invokes this principle a number of times, but one of the times at least is in the context of Demai. So Demai is an Issa D'Rabbana. It is a gzeira of Chazal out of a concern that tevel is mixed in with other foods you might be eating. So here you have a rabbinical prohibition. And yet the Gemara applies to it this idea of a takala. So this seems to indicate that there is a takala even within and it's a drabbanan. And again, there are different levels. Rav Spengel himself goes on to consider it's still possible that, say, the Nesivos is right and this is still true. It could be that there's no need for a kapara, per se, but still something bad. You still don't want it to happen. There's all kind of different gradations of what you mean, what you might mean by saying that Nisra drabbanan done inadvertently is not really an avera, but there could still be a takala, it could still be a negativity associated with it, so there's different gradations that are possible to maintain, but that's the thrust of his point over there. Okay, so far so good? Okay, again, that's a much longer discussion, much, much more to say about that, but that's the thrust of the point he wants to make about that. Now, if you look earlier in the Sefer, in Klal Vav, so he makes a similar point in a more narrow context. Because he raised that piece is about the question of Demai, specifically. So what is the nature of the Isser of Demai? So when Chazal said you have to worry about the possibility of Tevel being mixed into this produce, are they saying don't eat this because there may actually be Tevel in it, and therefore to avoid the Tevel, don't eat this? Or did they create an actual prohibited status on all of it, regardless of whether there's actually Tevel in it? So once they made their gezeira, it doesn't matter whether Eliyahu HaNavi can tell you if there's tevel or not. The fact is that it's usher anyway. It's usher in and of itself as the Yisra D'Rabbanan of Demai. So in that context, it makes a very similar point, just in this more narrow focus, that if the only concern is maybe there's tevel in there, so therefore you shouldn't eat it, so then it wouldn't make sense to say, oh, what about takala yidei tzaddikim? Because you could say, maybe there wasn't a takala. Maybe, yes, he ate this tamai, but there wasn't actually any tevel in it. So apparently, the Gemara invoking that is to tell you that no, it doesn't matter what the reality was, whether there was tevel or not in it. Tamai is itself a problem. Once we ask for tamai, tamai is prohibited, not only because of whether or not there is a reality of tevel in it. So essentially, just to recap, Rav Yosef Engel is making very prominent use of this Gemara in order to establish two points. One very broad and sweeping point about Yisurim Drabanan, that there is a negativity associated with it, even if it is a Issa Drabanan. And one more specific point about Tamai, that it takes on an objective status regardless of whether or not the concern of tevel is actually present in reality. Okay, makes sense? Okay, now, if we'll have patience for another point, he actually combines those two points in Klal Yud, where he says, maybe you might say the following. Maybe you might say that, well, an Issa d'Rabbanan maybe is normally, like the Nesivos indicates, maybe normally it's not a takala. But maybe it depends what kind of Issa d'Rabbanan we're talking about. We're talking about an Issa d'Rabbanan that's completely separate from anything. Okay, so then that doesn't have any inherent status. But if the nature of the Issa d'Rabbanan is that there might be a d'oraisa being violated, so maybe we should say that's treated like a d'oraisa because it has the possibility of a d'oraisa in it. So maybe we should say that d'mai is unique, or d'mai at least is different. That there, we treat that Issa d'Rabbanan like a takala, because there may be an Issa d'Oraisa mixed up in it. But a different Issa d'Rabbanan that doesn't have the possibility of a d'Oraisa being violated, then you wouldn't say that. So to that he says no, because again, if that was the concern, we could say in this case, because of the principle of Vein HaKadosh Baruch Hu maybe takala, so then there wasn't any concern. God protected him from having actual tevel, so it was only the d'Rabbanan that was the issue. So apparently, no, we see that the existence of the Rabbanan is a takala in and of itself, regardless of the reality of the Issa d'Oraisa being impacted, and that's what the Gemara indicates. Okay, this is relevant also in practice. Rav Asher Weiss, Shlita, has two shuvahs, which are interesting. All shuvahs are interesting, but two shuvahs relevant to this. In Chelek Aleph and in Chelek Beis, of the Sefer Menchas Asher Al Torah, no, I'm sorry, the Chuvas Menchas Asher. I'll come back to the Asher Al Torah in a second. In the Chuvas Menchas Asher, he discusses in Chelek Aleph, he talks about a situation where there was a certain butcher that sold meat, and he only realized after he sold the meat to the public that it wasn't salted. So essentially, he sold meat with blood in it. So there was a psak that was given that he's not obligated to make public what happened and to warn the people who bought the meat, because the people who bought the meat are going to be shogigim, are going to be anusim. They had no way of knowing this is the case. So therefore, they're not going to be in violation of any avera. So he was quite horrified at that psak. He said, that cannot be. And he says, it cannot be that just because a person who is doing something without knowing, or even without the possibility of knowing, so you say, onus rachmana patre, but it doesn't mean nothing wrong is happening. They're exempt from any kind of liability, but there's still an avera taking place. Follow? And he gives a somewhat extreme example, he says, if you're going to say that, then you could basically say to somebody, you could put a gun to someone's head and say, build my house for me on Shabbos, or plant my field on Shabbos, because that person will be an honest, he won't be liable for anything because you've got a gun to his head, and you won't be in violation of Lifnei Iver by making him do this because he's not doing anything wrong. So it's win-win, so to speak. So does that make any sense? Doesn't seem to. So he uses that example to suggest that it can't be that just because the person doing it is going to be an onus, that that puts no obligation on you to prevent that from happening. And he goes on to say that even though the blood's going to be cooked, which would make it nisa d'rabbanan, and the whole story with the nesivus and another d'rabbanan b'shogeg, first of all, he doesn't like the nesivus, he doesn't think it's correct, but he says even if you accept that position, again, it doesn't mean that it's nothing. It doesn't mean that it's not a takala that we would want to stop. So he was very firm on that point. And then in Chelek Beis, he has a tshuva, where he discusses a situation where there was a butcher who was under a very reputable, high-level hashgacha and sold meat to people and was later discovered to have been selling non-kosher food. So then the question came up, all the people who bought from him, who did so in the best of faith, thinking this has got the highest level hashgacha, what could possibly be wrong? And they ended up eating non-kosher food. So is there any kind of a tshuva that they should do, being that essentially they were completely duped? They were anusim. So here he also takes the position that if it's possible, he thinks there should be some tshuva done, as if he could fast for a day, or if that's not possible, give tzedaka, something along those lines. He thinks there is some tshuva to be done. And here he quotes again our Gemara Behemten Shul Tzedikim, and he quotes it to make the other point that we've seen, like from the Al Shulch and others, that if we were really on an appropriate spiritual level, so this wouldn't have happened even bonus. So the idea that it happened, it doesn't necessarily reflect a avera in that action, but it wouldn't have happened if there wasn't something to do tshuva for. So therefore, an appropriate response, based on the idea of Behemten Shel Tzadikim, is to do some kind of tshuva, essentially saying, what do you learn from Behemten Shel Tzadikim and HaKadosh Baruch Hu Takal Yadayim? That if a takala happens, it means we're not such tzadikim. And therefore, some tshuva should happen. And that a takala is going to apply, even if the Isser would be, theoretically, an Isser D'Rabbanan. Well, that's the point, more from the other tshuva. Hi.
Just in terms of how that relates to the Mordechai,
yeah.
And I know that we fleshed out a lot here in terms of how to even take it, like which side it was on. If it was saying that, I mean, can we revisit that Mordechai with what we've just said now?
Okay, always happy to revisit the Mordechai. Chashuv Rishon.
Do we see it as Rebbeinu Gershon telling Rashbam, don't rely. I'm still confused as to whether it's a riot at the same
time. Yeah, because it's a little bit of both. Let's restate it just to make it clear. So basically what was quoted in the Mordechai was that the Rashbam, we'll focus on one of the two cases, the Rashbam was about to violate an Isser inadvertently. He was about to get onto a carriage that was being drawn by Kiloi Behemoth, by animals that shouldn't be used together. And that was because he was looking down, he wasn't looking up, he was trying to be a parish, he was trying to be a tzaddik. And apparently, through a miracle, his brother Rebbeinu Tam appeared to him. And Rebbeinu Tam said, "Al tiksta karve, don't be so frum. Look up and see what's happening, and you see what you're about to get involved in." So the way it's presented there in the Mordechai is that he almost did something wrong, but he was saved because Behemtin Shul Tzadikim in HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mevi Takal Yadayim. So the question which Mori is bringing up is, how do you look at that story? You look at what almost happened or what did happen, what's the impact of that story? So on the one hand, what about the position of the Rishonim that's only relevant to matters of Achila? So this was not an Avera of Achila. So what does that tell us? Well, on the one hand, you could say, like Rav Nosson Gestetner says, that it's Rebbeinu Tam L'shitaso, because Rebbeinu Tam says to his brother, don't rely on Behemtin Shel Tzadikim. Because maybe L'shitaso, because it's not about Achila. But, Mori is asking, L'maisa, he was saved. That Rebbeinu Tam, by his presence, undermines his own point, because he's saying, don't do this, you're not going to get saved, and he saved him. So, what does that show us? So, it could be L'shitaso, that maybe the Rashbam disagreed, and there are other indications, and maybe the Rashbam had a more sweeping view. There's actually a Rashbam in Bava Kama, Bava Basra, did I put that other Rashbam Bava Basra? I put that on the list, I think, where it sounds like he applies it more broadly to issues of Psak. So it could be the Rashbam L'shita so. But the fact that he was saved here, does that disprove Rabbeinu Tam? Not necessarily. Because, as the Nos Imperio points out, Rabbeinu Tam could acknowledge that someone might be saved. He's just saying, don't take it as a given. But when the Gemara raises that as an assumption that it'll always be true, that the Hamtin Shetzadikim and Tzadikim Atzman will never have a Takala, that's only true about Midei D'Achila. But in other areas also, there might be protection. So the fact that the Rashbam was protected doesn't undermine his position that it's only bankable, it's only reliable when it's a matter of achil. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so just to also mention while we're talking about Rav Asher Weiss, just to add this, that he does have an essay about this in a Sefer Al HaTorah. There was a recent reprinting of the Menachas Asher Al HaTorah through the efforts of our friend Rabbi Shai Shechter Shlita, who brought about a beautiful reprinting of the Menachas Asher Al HaTorah, which is gracious, now is available. So it's much more material than the previous editions.
It's the same unit as the first five?
It has added pieces also. So it has that and more. So in last week's Parsha, in Parsha's Bereishis, he talks about this. Because in Parshas Bereishis, so we know there was the Aveira of Adam and Chava. But as far as Adam is concerned, so there was a opinion in the Medrash that he was basically duped. That Chava had squeezed the fruit into wine. According to one opinion in the Gemara, the fruit, according to every opinion, it was not an apple, but it was, according to one opinion, a grape. So if it was a grape, so she turned it into wine, according to this opinion, and handed it to him, and he didn't know that it was from the Eitz Hadas. So what does that say about his Aveira? So first of all, I have to figure out, okay, so apparently it wasn't Bemezid, but is that a Shogeg or is that an Onus? So if you look at the Or HaChaim, and you look at some of the other commentaries he quotes there, so first of all, this discussion, was Adam wrong to rely on her? Should we say that this is like an Aveira B'Shogeg because there's some negligence, he should have looked into it further? Or should we basically say really it's an Onus because it was completely appropriate for him to rely on her, just like in contemporary practice we rely on our wives and mothers and we say Edecha Nemen B'Sorin, and we don't assume that we have to question the kashrus of what we're given? So there you find different interpretations, but one way or another, we know that Adam paid a price for this. And so either, if this opinion is correct, so then there was a price to be paid for his consuming prohibited food items, either b'shogeg or b'onas. So he has a discussion about that in this context, and that's where he also references his own two tshuvas that I just related to you. And it's also relevant if those of you who are with us for Maseches Sukkah. We talked about Mitzvah Haba B'Aveira in that context. And we also talked about Bracha Haba B'Aveira. There is a very significant machlokas among the Rishonim. The Gemara says that if you steal grain and you make it into bread, so you can't make a bracha on that. Ein zeh mevarech ela menayetz. And the Rishonim argue about what bracha we're talking about that you shouldn't make. So some say, if the Ravid says, you shouldn't make a mezumin on it, because there's no chashivas on this, on the stolen bread. How could you have the chashivas of a mezumin? And the Meiri says it's talking about the mitzvah of hafreshes challah, that you can't make a berachas mitzvah on this bread that was stolen. But the Rambam says that you don't make a berachas hanenin, not tchila or sof, on any prohibited food, stolen or other prohibition, you don't make a bracha on it. And the Ravid disagreed. He says, how could you not make a bracha? Maisa, your nana, you should make a brachas on nana, and even if it was ba'avera. So there's a debate in the Rishonim about this. And the Rambam says, Beferish, says you don't make a bracha on an aveira whether the aveira was b'mezid or b'shogig. So if it was b'shogig, then presumably the question of bracha rishon is not going to come up because you don't know that you're doing something wrong. But maybe after the fact could come up, you make a bracha achrona if you find out afterwards that it was aser. So the rishonim argue around that point. This is brought in the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Kuf Tzadi Vav about what is the status of onus. What if you're forced to eat something that's not kosher? Let's say for medical reasons, you have to eat something that is treif in order to save your life. Do you make a bracha on that? If it's medicine that's treif, then you don't make a bracha even on medicine that's kosher. You don't make a bracha on medicine. But let's say it's food that you need to eat for health purposes or life-saving purposes, and it's treif food. So if it was kosher food, you do make a bracha. So what if it's treif food? So this was a machlokas rishonim, including in trying to interpret the Rambam. Should you say that, okay, this food is treif, but you're not doing an aveira in eating it? You have to eat it to save your life, so how do you interpret that? So that mean you should make a bracha because there's no aveira involved? Or does that mean you shouldn't make a bracha because even if there's no aveira involved, it's still treif food? Or maybe that makes it like medicine because it's food that you wouldn't eat except for the pikuach nefesh reality? So this was a machlokas rishonim, and it goes to this question again, is there a status that attaches even if there's no isser involved in doing it? The Brisker Rav was quoted as saying, in the Sefer Chavetz HaSharon, there's a pretty extensive discussion about Timtum Halev and all of the aspects of that and the idea that Machalos Asuras has an effect regardless of whether there's an Aveira or not, or whether there's liability or intent or not. So he talks about this in Parashat Shemini, where the Pasuk is, and also in Parashat Shmos. And there he quotes from the Brisker Rav that understood that the Timtum Halev is a function of the Aveira. So if there's no Aveira involved, such as you have to eat it for Pikuach Nefesh, so then there wouldn't be Timtum Halev. So that's a discussion. The Magen Avraham is Machalik between, if you want to talk about onus, there's different types of onus. So there's one kind of onus if somebody puts a gun to your head and says, eat this. And there's another kind of onus where somebody is really choosing to do it, but he's choosing to do it because it's going to save his life. So he's forced to choose this, but Lamaisa, he is of his free will eating this food. So the Magen Avraham thought, if someone puts a gun to your head and says, eat this tray food, so then there's no reason to make a bracha because that's a complete onus. But if you're choosing to eat it because it saves your life, so then there's a hana, so to speak, so you should make the bracha for that reason. So this was a major machlokas, how to relate to this issue, and it goes to this question of how do we look at machalos asuris even separate from an aveira connected to it. So, Yossi?
Yeah. I don't see the difference between a gun to your head and eating it to save your life.
So if somebody says, I'm going to kill you if you don't do this, so then there's really no decision involved in eating it. You just complete onus. It's forced upon you. While if you're doing this because you'll die otherwise, because you need it to save your life, so there's also a hechrich there. You're also being forced to at the cost of dying. So it's still an onus, but it's an onus in a different sense because you're still choosing to do this. So once you're choosing to do this, you should make a bracha because you're eating like you're eating anything else.
But aren't you just still choosing to eat it if there's a gun to your head?
No, because he says, I will kill you otherwise. So there's an external force.
You choose to eat it. It's the same.
No, but he's saying, I will kill you if you don't eat it. So this is becoming the focus of the onus. This is your only choice. There's some later svarim that are machalik between defining onus. I understand where you're coming from. You know, the confusion is understood. But just to put a sharper point on it, there are some who suggest a distinction between different types of onsen, even though they're both still onus. Like there's one kind of onus. It's interesting, actually. This is a Halachos Shabbos discussion. This is way out of our scope right now. But let's say you have a problem, and this has got to be removed because this is your problem. Right? So this person is threatening you, and you got to get rid of him because he's threatening you. Now, there's another type of onus where you have a threat that's coming from somewhere else, And there's 10 different ways in which you could save yourself from that threat. So, lemaisa, you're forced to pick one of them, so you're an onus in this whole process, but you're still choosing to do this particular act of your own free will. So even though they're both happening because you have no choice, you're, it's a life or death situation, but it's still different in its nature. So whether you buy that distinction or not, that's a distinction that some have suggested.
Does it have to do with like the time frame of like the immediate consequence?
Not necessarily. I think it has to do more that this is your problem, or and you have to get rid of it, or your problem comes from somewhere else, and this is one of the options you can do to address the problem, essentially. Okay, so still more to say about this topic, but the time is short. So those are some of the themes. Just to maybe recap one important point, to put in perspective, so the question of when does it apply and when does it not apply, it's maybe helpful just to recap some of the distinctions. So there are some who suggest that it applies only to achila and not to other things, and we discuss all the ramifications of that, and the unique qualities of achila and everything else that's associated with, and that's, of course, particularly relevant to our goal to understand the underlying themes of the Masechet Chulin. The second distinction the Ran and some other Rishonim had was that it's about pshio or not, that if a person is somehow negligent, so then problems can certainly emerge. But if a person is a tzaddik and is innocent in this case, and a tzaddik in general, so then we can expect a certain degree of protection. And a third distinction is that depends whether we're talking about the tzaddik himself or others, that maybe all the cases where we say there's not going to be a takala, that's when others would be affected. So maybe even though, yes, no one is perfect, everyone could sin, so the tzaddik himself could also sin. But the idea that a tzaddik is going to be involved in causing a takala for somebody else, so that maybe there's a shmira that there's not going to be a takala for others through him, and that could be compatible with our home source, the Gemara in Chulin and Daf Zayin, that the animal of the Pinchas Ben Yair, so first of all, it's his animal, it's not him, but also he was being fed by others, so it was a concern of others possibly violating the Isser of Meiser and Tavo, and it wasn't an Avera for him necessarily at all, and maybe that's consistent with such a distinction, that anyone can make a mistake, and ain't Sadik Baritz, anyone could end up committing an Avera, whether they intend to or not, but the point is that as far as its impact on other people, maybe that's going to be limited. Okay? Everybody good? All right, so now let's start in the time that we have, let's start talking about a plan for Chazara. So first, I guess let's try to